This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with a special program on international labor and the war on Afghanistan. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Even as we remember with horror the tragedy of the World Trade Center attack, we are now witnessing another horror. But this time the deaths are accumulating slowly, day by day. The World Trade Center attack was a deadly crime which led to the death of thousands of innocent people, most of whom were workers in the complex. We are witnessing in response another crime leading to deaths of more innocent civilians, but this time the victims are in Afghanistan. As the civilian casualties slowly mount, and as we look ahead to the deadly cold Afghan winter, keeping in mind the suffering and hunger of the hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees, we can only hope that the U.S. public regains its senses and that the labor movement will make a contribution in this regard.
When President Bush went to war with Afghanistan, the American public overwhelmingly supported it. Once the action ensued, the AFL-CIO's President John Sweeney almost immediately announced the Federation's support for the war. While a minority of unionists objected, the U.S. labor movement quickly fell in line behind the president. Interestingly, former President Clinton declared, "It's the economy, stupid," but President Bush has continued to focus on the war despite the fact that the economy is going to its own hell as the numbers of unemployed grow day by day. While much of the world's governments have supported the war to some extent, many of those same countries' unions and federations of unions have dissented. While there is little sympathy for those who destroyed so many lives at the World Trade Center, there is concern for the innocent lives already lost as well as those to be lost if the war is allowed to continue. To explore the positions of a number of key unions and federations across the globe, we have with us today Jeremy Deer, an officer of the National Union of Journalists in Great Britain, Hassan Lerget, press secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Karamat Ali is the education secretary of the Pakistan Workers' Confederation, and closer to home, Walter Johnson, secretary-treasurer of the San Francisco Central Labor Council. Gentlemen, welcome to Building Bridges.
Karamat Ali, let's start with you. Your country is closest to Afghanistan, and your union, the confederation that you're a member of, has issued a position paper in opposition to the war. Could you tell us a bit about why you've taken this stand?
Let's start from where it begins. On the 11th of September, the labor movement in Pakistan, we condemned the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, and we also supported the world community in its fight against terrorism. But our position was that terrorism will not be countered by waging a war. You have to find other means of countering terrorism. Our position is that, and we can already see that, this kind of war, which is being waged unilaterally by the United States, of course, Great Britain is its ally. But other than that, it doesn't have the sanction of the UN. It doesn't have a kind of consensus that could be called consensus of the world community. And we also feel that other avenues have not been fully explored. People in Pakistan feel while all forms of terrorism have to be eradicated, we should go into the root cause of what creates terrorism. And it is only the innocent civilians who become the first casualty, and this is what we have seen. We are in the fourth week of the air raids in Afghanistan, and we only hear about the innocent people being killed. And that is creating a lot of resentment in Pakistan, especially in the northern and southwestern parts of Pakistan, where Pashtun population lives. And they have immediate relatives on both sides of the border. So what we feared when we opposed this war, counterterrorism, it seems that is coming true. And the situation in Pakistan is particularly very disturbing because it is solidifying the same elements against whom this war is supposed to have been launched. All the fundamentalist elements in Pakistan, as you can see, they have come together. They are threatening to challenge the state, and they are gaining more and more sympathy, simply because people only get to know of the civilian casualties, more and more casualties. And people don't see any other sort of strategy to counter the root causes of terrorism. So that is the position of the labor movement in Pakistan right now. The war has been imposed upon Pakistan as well. We have already seen large-scale redundancies, closure of factories. All the export-related factories are being closed down. Thousands and thousands of people are getting unemployed. If you look at the economy of Pakistan, it is being estimated like in the first 3 months, Pakistani economy will lose to the tune of $2 to $3 billion. It is already a totally beleaguered economy, so the consequences for Pakistan are going to be horrendous in the economic sphere as well. And we feel even now the U.S. air raids should stop. They should try to find other means of isolating the Taliban. No sane person in Pakistan will support the Taliban government or Osama bin Laden or the strategies and tactics they employ or the kind of Islam they are trying to project. But we need to see something happening to counter those things. At the moment, you know, one only finds that the Taliban are coming out stronger. So that is the situation. And the labor movement is caught in a dilemma. On the one hand, you are faced with this growing unemployment. And for your information, only in early September, we had been able to get a national minimum wage. It was not much, but it was fixed at 2,500 rupees a month. And it was supposed to be implemented from the 1st of August. And now nobody is willing to pay even that minimum wage. So the working people are at the losing end at all levels. And this situation is likely to become even worse in the coming months if this war will continue. I must also add that in Pakistan, it is a very, very grim situation. If the bombing continues, it is very likely that Pakistan can be plunged into a civil war. It is very likely that Pakistan can be destabilized as a state. And that will be a much, much bigger horror for the whole humanity, because that will lead to unimaginable consequences, and it will in the end destabilize the whole of South Asia. So it is very, very important that people around the world seriously think about what is happening and pressurize the leaders in the US and Britain to take a reasonable course, go to the UN, take a legal course, use peaceful means, use means which will not harm the civilian population, and not devastate this already extremely devastated, unfortunate country.
Hassan Lorgat, press secretary of CLISATU. How is the Working Confederation in South Africa responding to the situation with the U.S. endeavors in the war? I should say the U.S. and certainly Great Britain.
In South Africa, CLISATU, with other progressive formations of civil society, are part of the anti-war movement. When the atrocities hit New York and Washington, there was a clear principled condemnation of the attacks. And starting from that, the unions and civil society generally have been mobilizing against war, similarly to the colleague in Pakistan, where we do believe that it is the working people and the poor who really suffer from this kind of, if you can call it a war, because really they don't seem to be two equally matched parties. So we take that principle view. Our government, today they mentioned that they would want the Americans ease off on the bombing and be more circumspect in terms of damage and injuries to civilians and killing of innocent people. But quite clearly the unions and civil society are in the street and will be marching on Friday and again on the 9th of November as part of an overall offensive against the WTO and such institutions. And the line we've really taken is that some people are quite concerned at the role the United Nations is playing. It seems to be underwriting these kind of attacks instead of trying to stop it, because its primary mandate was to stop wars, you know, especially when you have such mismatched power between the Americans and the richest country in the world with the poorest. So that's where we're really coming from in this regard. And I think we share with many progressive people the world over the so-called collateral damage, which refers to the innocent killings of so-called innocent civilians, really extends beyond those deaths. I mean, we're all finding that the left and radical ideas in our country and elsewhere are under some pressure because everything we speak about has to be watched. So some people find the need to introduce anti-terrorism legislation here. So there are fears by various organizations that the democratic space will be getting smaller and smaller. So that I regard as part of the collateral damage that these attacks have laid at our door.
And coming closer to the U.S., both geographically and, unfortunately, politically, Jeremy Dear from the National Union of Journalists in Great Britain. Can you tell us the position of your union and also what other unions in Great Britain, how they're responding to the crisis?
Certainly. I mean, I think the last point about radical ideas and dissent being under some pressure is even more the case in the UK, where clearly our own government have said they are standing shoulder to shoulder with the United States. And that on the back of that, the press has been overwhelmingly in favour of the bombing campaign and has been largely jingoistic in its nature. So dissenting voices amongst civil society and amongst trade unions has been difficult. But there is a growing perception across all layers of society that having the richest country on earth, bombing the poorest country on earth, a country already pretty much rubble in large areas, having suffered 20-odd years of conflict, isn't going to solve the problem the US and the UK government claim that their action is there to solve. I think for my own union, there's a particular concern about the fact that a number of governments across Europe are attempting to use the current political climate to push through so-called counter-terrorist legislation covering measures in the UK like phone tapping, police surveillance, encryption technology, all those sorts of things that are being used not just against those alleged terrorists but are being used against those who are protesting against the effects of the bombing campaign and the collateral damage and everything else, but also those anti-globalisation protesters and others. In terms of other unions, a number of unions have now come out specifically against the war. Just yesterday, in fact, the Communication Workers Union, 280,000-odd members, have called for the bombing to stop. Both the rail unions in the UK, the RMT and ASLEF, have called for an end to the war. The lecturers, College Lecturers Union, NATFI, has done the same. The Bakers Union. And the public sector unions, Unison and the Fire Brigades Union, have all expressed pretty serious reservations about the military offensive and in particular the innocent lives being lost. So where at the outset of this campaign there was a huge level of support for the bombing in the immediate aftermath, today's newspapers report there's a poll in one of them with a 12% drop over the past few weeks in the level of support for the American-led campaign. And also within that same poll, 54% saying that there should be a pause in the bombing to allow aid convoys and humanitarian aid in. That's a very big change from the position that there was 4 or 5 weeks ago. So although dissent has been difficult, and in fact one of our MPs who spoke out saying that he believed that the Parliament should be able to have a vote on whether we go to war, has been roundly criticised by the Labour Party here and in fact called an appeaser, similar to the people who appeased Hitler in the 30s. Despite all that and all the pressure on people, there is now a growing dissent about the aims of the campaign, the nature of the campaign, and indeed the kinds of definitions of terrorism. People say things like, wasn't the training of contra-guerrillas to overthrow the government in Nicaragua, wasn't that also a terrorist training camp and a terrorist action? And there are all sorts of questions now being raised, and it's a healthier debate than certainly it was in the immediate aftermath of September the 11th.
As we've mentioned earlier, the AFL-CIO waited not at all to rush to support of the war. Walter Johnson of the San Francisco Central Labor Council, you're one of the few organizations in the labor movement that has formally institutionally come out against the war. How did that position evolve, and why are your members taking what would seem to be a departure from so many other union members in the United States at this time?
Well, we in San Francisco, Northern California, are a little different, I guess. On September the 24th, at our meeting of delegates, we passed a statement regarding the tragic events of September 11th. This was passed by a high margin there, so it was the statement for the Labor Council. We're getting calls from around the United States for other labor organizations that want to use it. But we have stated, and part of it I'll read, Many of those killed were union members and others, workers killed on the job. Our hearts go out to our sisters and brothers and their loved ones. We particularly honor the rescue workers that continue to risk their lives to save others. No one in this country or any other should suffer the fate of the victims in these attacks. We demand that the perpetrators of these crimes be brought to justice. The tragic attacks of September 11th should be treated as a heinous crime rather than an act of war. As we mourn the tremendous loss of life, we declare our resistance to efforts to use this tragedy to engage in military action that can lead only to more carnage and senseless loss of life. We reject the idea that an entire nation should be punished for the actions of a few. Bombing raids and military strikes will only fuel an endless cycle of revenge that can only bring the deaths of more innocent civilians both here and around the world. In the face of such sorrow, we urge all people, particularly members of the labor family, to stand united against prejudice, hatred, and intolerance wherever it arises. Within our own borders, we call upon all of our communities to join us in immediately confronting any anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, anti-Sikh, or any other anti-immigrant hate speech or acts of violence, whether in our neighborhoods, our workplace, or in the media. We strongly oppose efforts to curtail the rights of immigrants and refugees. We also declare resistance to efforts to use this tragedy to curtail our civil liberties. We encourage open discussion as to the origin of this crisis and the most appropriate response to the atrocities that have taken place, particularly about the need for a foreign policy that is based on economic and political justice. I won't read any more, but that's kind of summing up where we are. And it was passed by the delegates. And as I said, we're getting requests from around the United States to join in this statement that we have here.
Let's go back to Pakistan now and Karamat Ali, the Education Secretary of the Pakistan Workers' Confederation. Tell us a little bit more about the nature of organizing and some of the regular issues that affect Pakistani workers.
You see, the major issue in organizing in Pakistan is that since 50% of the labor force in agriculture doesn't have the right to organize, so that we start with a big disadvantage anyway. Then if you look at the non-agriculture economy, more than 80% of employment there is in the informal sector, which is extremely difficult to organize given the nature of laws regulating a right of association. Given all those difficulties, at the moment, less than 4% of the labor force, industrial and commercial sector in Pakistan is organized. So the trade unions do not represent more than 4% of the labor force directly. We cannot form industrial or general unions under the existing laws at this moment. So it's only enterprise or rural unions that are formed. And that leaves out the large mass of Pakistani workers who are employed in the informal sector, in the small-scale sector, to be able to organize. And then the other major problem that we have is the introduction at a very large scale of the contract system. This is a misnomer in a way. It's known as contract system, but this deals with workers who have no contract of employment. They are employed by the so-called contractors, indirect employers. While they work in large-scale factories, they are not treated as direct employees of the principal employer. And that is the case with all industrial and commercial sector in Pakistan. Even in the large multinationals working in Pakistan, up to 60 or even 70% of the workforce is employed through these so-called contractors. And that means those workers remain deprived of even the very, very basic rights of, say, a paid weekly holiday, or an overtime payment after 8 hours of work, no medical or sick leave, or no casual leave. So they basically work on a daily basis on piece rates, and they are the most vulnerable workers at this moment. And they constitute the core of the workers in the export sector. Now, we hear a lot about social clause and other sort of such measures, but essentially, an overwhelming majority of the workers in the export sector, which is mainly textile, remains totally unprotected and extremely vulnerable. The other important factor to keep in mind is that a large majority of Pakistani workers are migrant workers, migrants within Pakistan. They come from various regions of Pakistan to a few large industrial centers like Karachi, Lahore, and a few other centers. But we also have a large number of what are known as illegal migrants coming from Bangladesh, Burma, and more than 2 million Afghan refugees who are there since the past 20 years. So that creates another layer of vulnerable workers who are compelled to work under inhuman conditions for really very little wages and no rights at all. So Pakistani labor movement functions under these conditions. And whatever unions survive, they are basically one in the public sector, which of course has seen a large reduction as a result of large-scale privatization in the 90s, and in very large private firms where some level of skills becomes necessary, so they need a kind of a relatively stable labor force. Otherwise, the migrant and unprotected nature of the workers is a big block in terms of organizing, and the Pakistani laws make things even more complicated. So this is the situation of the labor movement. Then, of course, like many other developing countries, the labor movement also remains quite divided. We have a large number of federations, even people maybe sort of having same kind of ideological orientation refuse to join hands to form a single organization. They do not work together. This is the kind of situation of the labor movement. But given also the totally unprotected situation of the majority of the workers, if you look at the present context, these fundamentalists have been able to recruit a large number of such workers to their cause, and which is extremely alarming, because if you look at the protests by the fundamentalists in Karachi, they are not protests against war. They are protests in support of the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, and their numbers are growing, and they originate in the working class neighborhoods. So, as I was saying earlier, we really need to look at what really creates the ground for the breeding of terrorism. And one important factor that we must keep in mind, and which is common to sort of all kinds of trade unions in Pakistan, is that there is a universal disenchantment with the policy of the United States, especially with reference to Pakistan, because people know that it was the United States which had been promoting all kinds of undemocratic governments in Pakistan, all kinds of authoritarian regimes. I remember, you know, one particular instance when the so-called democracy was restored in Pakistan in 1988. We had a functionary of the U.S. Embassy visiting our trade union office in Karachi to discuss the labor situation. And when we discussed the issue of the contract labor, he said, look, if you continue to oppose contract labor system, then I'm afraid you will not get any foreign investment. And then, of course, if there is no foreign investment, your economy is not going to pick up. And that is not good also for the labor movement. I said, look, I mean, then maybe you should ask the government to abolish the constitution that we have, because our constitution guarantees certain rights to all citizens, including workers. And this system is basically depriving the workers of their very basic rights. So if we talk about democracy, it should include rights of the workers as well. But, you know, that it was quite surprising for me that, you know, on the one hand, you want to promote democracy, but you actively campaign for denying basic rights to workers. So there has been this kind of very close involvement of the U.S. in Pakistan. People also have very, very bitter memories of what happened in the 80s and early 90s. You know, the so-called Mujahideens were brought together, based in Pakistan. Actually, the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan was practically obliterated to wage this war against the former Soviet Union. And at that time, these people were glorified as Islamic fighters, and we saw pictures of these same people who, you know, who are the, in a way, forebearers of the Taliban, with the President of the United States, with the Prime Minister of England, and really eulogizing them. And in fact, if I remember correctly, one particular group of Mujahideen was invited to the White House, and the President Ronald Reagan likened them to the forefathers of the American nation. They were fighting for liberty. And we knew what was happening in Pakistan. It was basically giving rise to this kind of intolerant version of Islam.
Hassan, I think you were going to also...
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that Ali raises. this whole Taliban, Osama bin Laden, this whole Al-Qaeda movement seems in part, as Ali mentions, and this is the side, being a creation jointly of the CIA, the Pakistani intelligence, and the Soviets, who are all together on one side, although they may have supported different sides, you know. So for us, this is quite interesting how expedient the powers that be can be. But I wanted to raise the issue about, like all wars, yeah, the truth is one of the casualties, and we believe that our only sources of information, our prime sources, are CNN, BBC, World, and we have two, our own broadcasters here, ETV has sent a South African television that's for the first time got a person right in Afghanistan. So for the first time last night, we saw from South African footage little babies and children who are dying. And really, I think this picture does present quite a different view of what Americans and maybe the others in the UK are seeing, you know, besides, of course, the Al Jazeera coverage which people get. And I really think that the news that we are getting is really sanitized, and we are, I mean, for the first days of the bombing in New York and Washington, we saw CNN, America version, if you like, the American home news, for about 7 days. And it's quite interesting. We didn't see the familiar multicolored cultural kind of people, Indian and other broadcasters. We only saw the white American broadcasters of CNN, and we could see what kind of messages were getting out to the American people. And I'm not surprised that the responses have been what they are, because if you stand outside the jingoistic kind of cry and call for war and anthrax scares and et cetera, et cetera, it's really a mobilization. So we could sense that for the first 7 or 10 days. It's only now, as I said, that our own broadcasters are trying to adopt a more critical view, and we're seeing the view from the victims inside Afghanistan.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg with our special international program on war in Afghanistan. Our guests are Jeremy Deer, an officer of the National Union of Journalists in Great Britain, Hassan Lerget, press secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Karamat Ali, education secretary of the Pakistani Workers' Confederation, and Walter Johnson, secretary treasurer of the San Francisco Central Labor Council.
Jeremy Deer from Britain.
I think on this whole question, the press coverage and media coverage in the UK, there has been some very good reporting, but there has been much more very bad reporting. And I think that's the case all across Europe. I know there was an editorial in one of the main French daily papers, which summed up the attitude, we are all Americans now. And that's kind of the, up until now, the dissent, the voice of dissent in the newspapers has been kept at a very low level, if it appeared at all. But yesterday there was quite a kind of remarkable change in one of our, the second biggest selling tabloid newspaper in the UK, used John Pilger, who is a famous anti-establishment journalist, was the foreign editor of the Daily Mirror for many years. They used him on the front page with a huge headline saying, this war is a fraud, and then devoted two pages inside to his perception of the war. And he talked about the 500,000 people who died in Iraq as a result of the sanctions and a whole range of other issues, and talked about the need, which I think is one of the big questions, that if we're having a war, let's have a war against poverty and a war against the causes of terrorism, rather than seeking to indiscriminately bomb an entire population on the grounds that they believe terrorists may be hiding in caves or in residential areas in those countries. If we could only mobilize kind of even a tenth of the resources that are being devoted to military action to civil action in order to try to deal with poverty, with disease and all the other things that give fuel to groups like Al-Qaeda and others, then we would be able to take some significant steps forward in cutting the ground from under those people who seek to use these means to get across a point that they feel they don't have any other means of getting across. So the two things kind of link in together. The feeling of powerlessness that many people have, but also the fact that they see that Western nations have such huge resources. Those resources aren't used to help deal with many of the problems in these countries. But when they are used to bomb these countries and to protect the kind of vital interests of the US and the UK and the European Union countries.
But in the shadow of all this, it's Hassan again.
Right.
In the shadow of all this, the Palestinians continue to be shot, as we see in many of the channels.
Yeah.
So really, what's happening is that I think in our country, the genuine sympathy for Americans is dissipating by the day, especially when those who support the Palestinians and their many here take to the streets and say, well, Palestinians get killed in silence. It seems as if there's a license now in the shadow of this big war. The persecution of Palestinians in particular continues. Of course, the assassination of the minister of tourism there did take place, of course, or the Israeli minister. But I think that these things seem, as many journalists and others have been talking about, seem to be playing to the agenda as put out publicly by Osama bin Laden. You know, he mentions the issues which are festering sores in the Middle East and elsewhere. So I really think that, as you said, that we need to really spend more time addressing the causes of the festering sores have to be really healed from root.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is Karamas again. I think I fully agree with what Hassan was saying. I mean, if you talk to an ordinary Pakistani, I'm sure 90% of the people in Pakistan are against the kind of Islam that these fundamentalists are promoting. But they always refer to what happens in Palestine. People also remember, and this is really ironical. I mean, if you look at, say, 1991, what were being told? We were being told, you know, okay, Iraq had occupied Kuwait. Nobody could support that. And that was stated to be the end of that war. Now what we have, 10 years later, we have the same Saddam Hussein, who is maybe even more stronger in his position as the president of Iraq. We have the same kind of sort of Kuwaiti government, but more than 500,000 children in Iraq have died. And still the bombing continues. The sanctions have not been lifted. And this news gets to the ordinary people. Now, how do you expect them to take when, for example, George Bush II, and it's the same team, you know, people see. See, like the same Colin Powell, same Dick Cheney, same sort of George Bush. And people really question when he says, you know, CNN is showing this short, very short kind of a snap every second sort of a minute, where George Bush II tells us, our war is just. Now, this just and justice, people don't accept this from the mouths of people who have stood with all kind of injustice in the past, even in Afghanistan. It is a known fact now that the U.S. government for the past 2-3 years was in negotiation with Taliban over oil pipelines. They had no problems with them. Even when Osama bin Laden had already come to Afghanistan, they had no problems with them. Now, the only solution you find is to bomb the ordinary people of Afghanistan. You don't even have the intelligence to locate these people. I mean, it's amazing. First of all, I mean, the people in the United States, and I mean, it's very interesting what Walter was saying. People must ask their government, what kind of intelligence service is there in the U.S. which fails to trace these people who go and hijack these planes? They are in the air for 1.5 hours. And they go around doing their dirty job totally unhindered. And not a single person in the intelligence services of the U.S. has resigned to date, to my knowledge. I mean, even if a small accident takes place, some person will take responsibility for that failure. Nobody has taken the responsibility. Okay? Those innocent people died. 5,000, 6,000, but these the ruling elite is sitting pretty. And now they are waging this war and they're trying to convince people this is the only way of dealing with terrorism. Unfortunately, this is not going to lead to the end of terrorism. I really shudder to see what is happening in Pakistan. You know, 10, 12 men who are carrying these T-shirts and posters of Osama bin Laden, they are the potential terrorists of the next 10 years or so. So you do not deal with terrorism the way you are trying to deal with it. You really have to be committed to justice, and you have to be committed to the rule of law. I mean, how are you different from Osama bin Laden, who sort of professes use of violence and arbitrary force to press for whatever cause he might have? You do the same thing. You totally disregard international law. After all, there are international institutions, no matter how bad their performance has been. But somewhere, you have to make a break. You have to break this vicious cycle of violence, arbitrariness, you know, the might is right kind of attitude. You have to really build these institutions, allow them to function in a just manner. Only then you can start dealing with the root causes of terrorism. You know, like there was a big peace conference in The Hague in 1999. There were people were discussing the issue of nuclear disarmament, and there was someone representing the government of the United States. And he was asked when the U.S. will really agree to total nuclear disarmament. And his answer was, look, I can't really say, but it doesn't look like in the next century or so. Then how do you expect other people to do it? You will find more nuclear states coming up. So the U.S. has to change its policies fundamentally. And I think it's the responsibility of the people in the United States. I mean, this horrible tragedy should shake them up. They should wake up. They should stand up and ask their government what kind of policies they have been pursuing all around the world. What do people think of the Americans today? I mean, for no fault of them.
Walter Johnson, president of the San Francisco Central Labor Council. I mean, what do you think about some of the things that have been raised by our brothers from Africa and Pakistan and Great Britain?
Well, I think they're legitimate statements that have been made. The important thing, how to get the message across over here. And that's what we are working on, and we're going to continue to push our message in there. The important thing, I guess, is, among many other things that have been mentioned, is definition of the word just. They say a just war or something like that. Well, how can you justify something that will go out and we've had this terrible tragedy here, which we all recognize, but then we shouldn't be playing get even. And we should be looking to find out who caused it, but not going out making sure that a lot of other people are dying, innocent people who had nothing to do with it, to try to demonstrate our strength. Our strength really will come from having the patience in that to really make sure that what we do is not going to affect others. And I think, unfortunately, that the word patriotism sometimes causes people to take actions that are not really the right type of an action that's patriotic. And we went through all of this during the Vietnam War in the beginning, and that finally the eyes were opened, but too late. So we just have to hope. And I'm glad to hear the different messages that are coming about, because I need more of that to exchange information. And so we get the picture as what it is from other areas. And that's our responsibility. Not just go on a one-way street down there and say this is what has to be done. So I think as time goes by here, and probably not too long, that there will be more eyes opened. And I'm sure this is going to be discussed at many of the different AFL-CIO meetings around the country.
I think that last point is extremely important about us sharing information about what is happening across the globe in terms of the demonstrations, in terms of anti-war movement, in terms of the press coverage and everything else, because it's on that basis that people gain strength to carry on organizing when they are in places where dissent is either not tolerated or is very difficult because of this kind of false patriotism that is put up to get us all pulling together. And I think in preparing for this, I surfed some of the websites both in the US and in Europe looking at finding out about some of the demonstrations that there have been. And just for people's information, 200,000 people on one march in Italy, largest demonstration since the 60s, 100,000 people protesting in Rome on the 29th of September, 40,000 people in Naples on the 27th of September, 15,000 people in Barcelona on the 29th of September, other sizable demonstrations in Berlin, in Paris, in Brussels, in Amsterdam, 50,000 people marching in London, another 1,500 in Scotland on the same day, 25,000 in Germany. Although it is clear that we are in a minority, it is a sizable minority and one that is growing, and I think that's an important message to get across, because the point that's being made about in the immediate aftermath, there is this jingoism, there is this patriotism that comes to the fore. But when they start talking about, when we start to see the real pictures and hear the real voices of people from other areas of the world, people do begin to question. And when working people, whether it's in Afghanistan or in Pakistan or in London or in San Francisco, are made to suffer for these actions, then people really do begin to question. And we're now talking here very much so about people being made to pay for the amount of money that's being spent on this campaign through job losses, through recession, through cuts in wages, through wage freezes, and things like that. And that brings it home very, very starkly to people. Unfortunately, that has to be the case, that is brought home very starkly in their own kind of neighbourhoods about people suffering here in order to pay for a war of which they are not really very supportive anyway. So I think it's important that as much as possible we are able to exchange information and get that information into the public domain as much as possible.
Yeah, we've been getting some of this information here in South Africa via the internet and stuff like that. I mean, it seems very difficult for people organizing in America in particular, where we've learned that really the CEOs and others are taking their full pay while workers have been laid off. You know, so there are a number of these contradictions that we are picking up. Maybe that's not necessarily correct, but there seems to be a difficulty that the labor movement is facing to try and defend its members and also keep in touch with the national mood, you know, however that is being structured. I mean, the difficulty we are having here in terms of, I mean, clearly the airline industry as a whole, the world over, is suffering some kind of setback, of course, a world recession that we're going through. But the difficulty we're having in the anti-war movement is whom do you get to march with you? You know, can you be all that choosy? Because some people simply come that they're opposed in principle to the war, but others come from a religious conviction, like we have a Muslim constituency, 3% of our population here. Others come and quite contradictorily, and to try and keep a balance that American working people and others really are with us in this is a goal, and if we try and propagate, but it's something that gets blurred when young Americans go out and fight, like young people all over the world, working class people are the ones who are recruited into the armies, you know. So these are tough, and we're not having it so easy to try and explain the need for a kind of global movement for justice, because our constituencies are being mobilized behind national patriotic causes, you know.
Well, I think among other things, it's Walter Johnson again there, that we all are a little bit guilty, I'd say, because unfortunately it usually takes a tragedy like this to bring people together and become the unifying agent. And we have a responsibility to try to build back many years ago, before most of you were born. When I was in World War II, I was a journalist, and I blew things up. But I also participated in building bridges, and this is what we need to do now more than ever, not just during these major problems like this, but to try to develop a better bridge-building process around the world so we have better contacts. And the other point that was made about television or something like that, we should have a mixed racial group reporting and all of that. So I think among all of us, we have things to learn when these tragedies take place. And let us hope that we don't be a Roman candle and then let it die after all of this is over.
Well, do you think also, though, that the Bush administration is using the war to get through a far-right agenda, especially with regard to the tax cuts and other measures that are being put through on civil liberties that really have nothing to do with the war?
Yeah, I think it's being used in that because if you remember back in the other war, President Bush at that time, his popularity rose considerably. Of course, it went down later on. But I think right now, for instance, President Bush is pushing, and the Republicans are pushing, the economic stimulus, which, of course, is great for the corporate citizen, but not for the individual citizen. Instead of being an economic stimulus, from our point of view, it's an economic stranglehold. And they're using this, among other things, to try to put out a different picture than what is really the theory of reality. And I think, to a certain extent, this is being used for that.
So he's presenting himself more as a person who got more votes than he actually got now.
Yes, well, precisely.
He's a selected president.
Yes, Karamat Ali.
Hassan mentioned the need for a global movement for justice. I just wondered where it has to be a movement for justice and peace, because I don't conceive of a situation where you can achieve justice without there being peace. And in this regard, I think since we are all from the labor movement, I think it is really very important that the international labor movement also does some introspection. I think the participation of the international labor movement in the peace movement is very weak. And we see mostly labor organizations and labor movements being motivated more by nationalist concerns rather than global internationalist concern for labor as such. And this is, I think, the time. It's a historic moment. I personally feel, you know, this was a historic moment even for the ruling establishments to pause for a while and see, okay, this tragedy has happened, and can we move towards establishing peace, creating a world free of wars and terrorism and deprivation. But they have failed. They have chosen to launch a war, basically a declaration that they will continue in their old ways. I think it's a historic moment for all of us to really sit back and think whether we are capable of launching a peace offense, whether we are capable of launching a global movement for justice and peace. And I don't think we have any other option. We have seen that happening at a number of junctures. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, for example, we were faced with a similar situation. And most of the labor movement succumbed to the nationalist consideration. And then we had what we had. I think it is still time that while we oppose this bombing campaign against the unarmed innocent civilians of Afghanistan, we should really think of, you know, some kind of a global discussion in the labor movement for peace, global peace, not peace for just one country or the other, for one people or the other, but global peace and global justice. I think the labor movement has a big responsibility, and it can play a very, very big role in that. Now, while taking this opportunity of this discussion, I would put to all the participants, can we think of, in a way, convincing the existing leaderships in the labor movement internationally to convene as quickly as possible a global labor conference for peace and justice? I think this is the time we should act as labor.
Well, as we wind down, perhaps Hassam Lorgat, who is the press secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, and Jeremy Deer, an officer of the National Union of Journalists in Great Britain, and Walter Johnson from the San Francisco Central Labor Council. Why don't we all make concluding statements, perhaps following some of the things that Karamat Ali has said, and I can't help but think of this as, indeed, the war spreads and its destabilizing elements. developments. Certainly we haven't even begun a discourse on what's happening in the Philippines, the tragedy of the assassinations recently in Pakistan in a Christian church, and against the backdrop, indeed, of what is happening now in Nigeria. So if we can make some concluding statements, and I hope that we can feel free to contact all of you as we continue our international dialogue to look at how to rectify the abuses that have stimulated this war effort, and to contradict George Bush and make sure that this is an effort that really ceases and desists immediately, and that is the bombing and the war efforts against Afghanistan. Hassan?
Yeah, I must say, I, in principle, from the discussion that we've had, and he talks about a global movement of justice from below, essentially, it's the kind of thing that we want to go for. I must say that while wars are bad, at least this time, with the advent of the internet and such likes, we are getting a lot more alternative information. In fact, it's vibrant. In fact, that we can be on your radio station is an advance from this war, between this, comparing this war with the others. And we can deepen this democracy from below. We have to build an independent media voice so that our information can be unsullied when it reaches working people, because too much commercialization and the powers that be in the conglomerates really distort these messages. We believe, I think it was a Guardian piece which we got here, that the Pentagon has been involved in buying up some of these kind of broadcasters' coverage so that the Americans can be saved this view of the horrendous kind of acts that they're perpetrating in as revenge. So those kind of things I really think is a enduring lesson for me. I really think that the movement's quite strong. There are differences, however, that we need to try and work through. And this can be done. I work in particular with the teachers, and I speak here on behalf of COSATU, but I work with the teachers' union, and we have to try and draw connections. How do we interpret this at the bottom of Africa, what's happening up there? How does this not divide us, you know, and how can we all be enriched? Because we are a multicultural society here. So there are real challenges that we have to handle quite adroitly. And I think that it's sad that the war has to do it. We're grappling.
And Jeremy Deer from Britain.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would conclude with a great deal of what's been said there. What my own union is trying to do here, alongside groups that have been set up like Media Workers Against the War, is trying to promote as much pluralism as possible in debate and ensure that the free flow of information, and to protect those journalists who are trying to tell a different side of the story, who are trying to reveal the facts about the effect of the bombing in Afghanistan, and indeed the movements in other Muslim countries, in other parts of the world, against the action in Afghanistan, because all too often we don't hear enough about that. I think what we all need to commit ourselves to, and it's come out in a number of areas, is the advancement of workers' rights everywhere, whether it's in San Francisco or Kabul or in Pakistan or in London. It's vital that workers see that their interests are the same across the globe, and that they don't tie in with the interests of always the multinational companies, or indeed our own government, when it comes to situations like this, and that we use our best resources to develop as much as possible a movement of citizens, of trade unionists, of workers, in order to push forward what our interests are, whether it's about the war or whether it's about the minimum wage and the other issues that were being talked about earlier. I think that's vital for all of us.
And Walter Johnson, Secretary-Treasurer of the San Francisco Labor Council.
Okay, I'll make it short. You know, saying to remain silent when we should speak out makes cowards out of men and women. So therefore, we must be the voice of conscience and send our message out loudly and clearly across the nation and the world.
Well, we'd like to thank all of you. This has been a most eloquent and insightful discourse. It's really very gratifying from my end of things to hear sisters. No sisters. That has to be corrected next time.
It's all my fault, as usual.
Next time we need sisters, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Men are the fighters in the war.
But to at least hear my brothers in the labor struggle and their sense of justice.
For a moment, may I interrupt? Because, see, that's a No, as a, what would you say, against me because I'm an honorary sister of Now. And in front of 650 people, I was declared an honorary lesbian.
That could only happen in San Francisco.
And I was introduced, they said, they don't know what color I am. So, I mean, be careful what you say because you don't want to discriminate against me.
I was one of the
honorary. I love it. Well, thank you all.
Thank you. It's been very gratifying
and very heartening to hear your discourse, and I can tell you we will certainly call and bother you all again to find out more, of course, about the respective day-to-day issues within the various countries we've spoken with and, of course, the concerns around this war. Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
Cheers.
This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report's special program on international labor and the war in Afghanistan. Building Bridges is produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Our guests have been Jeremy Deer, an officer of the National Union of Journalists in Great Britain, Hassan Loget, Press Secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, Karamat Ali, Education Secretary of the Pakistan Workers Confederation, and Walter Johnson, Secretary Treasurer of the San Francisco Central Labor Council.
For more information about labor organizing against the war in Afghanistan, you can contact laboragainstwar@yahoogroups.com.
Building Bridges is regularly heard on Internet Radio, WBAI in Exile, www.wbix.org, on Tuesdays from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can email us at knash@igc.org, and you can hear past specials on our website, www.buildingbridgesradio.org. For Building Bridges, this is Ken Nash with Mimi Rosenberg in solidarity.